Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're doing something a little different. We're narrowing our focus quite a bit, actually.
We are. We're basically running a study guide session. This is aimed squarely at first-year economics students who are, you know, probably deep in their econometrics course right now.
That's right. Specifically, we're tackling Chapter 13 of Analysis of Economics Data. So if you're a student, maybe cramming for an exam, this is for you. Or if you're a professional who just wants a refresher on, well, the fundamentals of regression.
And the chapter title itself is really the key to our mission today. It's multiple regression case studies.
The case study part is what matters, isn't it? It's one thing to see the betas and the sigmas on a blackboard, all the abstract math, but it's another thing entirely to see how it works with actual messy, real-world data.
Exactly. And that's the bridge we want to build today, moving from that dry theory to what happens when you actually apply it. Because, you know, any software package, Stata, R, Python, whatever you're using, can run a regression.
You can feed it garbage, and it will give you a number back.
It will. It'll give you a coefficient, a p-value. The whole works.
Mm-hmm.
The real challenge, the skill you're learning as a student, isn't the computation, it's the interpretation.
It's knowing why you set the model up a certain way.
And, just as importantly, knowing when the results are telling you something misleading, knowing why a model might look like it's broken.
Okay, so we've got a lot of ground to cover. We want this to be a really complete review. We're going to structure this deep dive around the text itself, breaking it down into 5 parts.
Right. We'll start with a California school performance case. That'll get us through the basics of multiple regression. Then from there, we'll look at the Cobb-Douglas production function.
And that's where we get into nonlinear data.
That's the one. After that, we tackle what is, I think, one of the most important concepts in the whole chapter, omitted variable bias. And we'll use the famous breakdown of the Phillips curve to understand it.
From there, a kind of rapid-fire review of some more advanced techniques.
Yep, a quick tour of 5 specific causal inference methods. We're talking about things like randomized controlled trials, difference in differences, all the way up to instrumental variables.
And then we'll finish up with something that's often overlooked, but is maybe the most practical part of the whole process.
Data carpentry, or data wrangling, as some people call it. The not-so-glamorous work that comes before you can do any analysis at all.
All right, so grab your notebook, a cup of coffee. Let's get started. Part 1, the basics of multiple regression and the California School Performance Index.
Okay, so the data set here is called API 99. And the very first step before you write a single line of code for a regression is to understand what data you're even looking at.
So what's in the box?
We have a sample of 807 high schools. This is all from California, and the data is for the year 1999.
And the main thing we're trying to explain, our dependent variable, our Y variable, is the API score.
Correct. The Academic Performance Index. For your purposes, you just need to know it's a number, a continuous variable, that goes from 200 up to 1,000.
And there's a policy goal attached to this.
There is. The state of California wants schools to score above 800. So the research question, the whole point of the analysis, is pretty straightforward. What factors, what variables, can predict a higher API score?
Okay, so what are our predictors? What are our X variables? The text seems to split them into 2 groups.
That's a good way to look at it. You've got, on the one hand, socioeconomic factors, and on the other, you have school-specific inputs.
Let's start with the socioeconomic side. The first one is ed parent.
That's the average number of years of education for the parents at that school. Then you have meals, which is the percentage of students who are on free or reduced price lunch programs.
Which is a common proxy for poverty levels in a school district.
Exactly. And the last one in that group is Englearn, which is just the percentage of students who are designated as English learners.
Okay, so those are the big societal factors. What about the things a school principal or a school board might actually be able to change?
Right, the school inputs. We have cred teach, which is the percentage of teachers who are fully credentialed. Then, it's opposite, emer teach, the percentage of teachers working on an emergency credential.
So a measure of teacher qualification.
A direct measure, yes. And the last one is year-round, which is what we call a binary or a dummy variable. It's just a 1 if the school operates year-round and a 0 if it doesn't.
So before we jump into any fancy regressions, the text says the first step is something called univariate analysis. Why start there? What does that even mean?
It just means looking at one variable at a time. Specifically, you want to look at your target variable, your Y, in this case, the API scores. You'd plot a histogram of it.
And what are you looking for?
You're checking its distribution. You want to see if it's, you know, roughly bell-shaped, what we call normally distributed. The text notes that the API scores are, in fact, normally distributed, and that's by design of the index itself.
And why is that an important check?
It's a fundamental methodological check. If your data was, say, heavily skewed with a long tail, or if it had two distinct peaks, what we call bimodal, that might tell you that a simple linear regression isn't the right tool for the job. You might need a different approach. But here, the data is playing nice. It's well-behaved.
Okay, so the data is good to go. The text then moves to a bivariate regression, bi meaning two. So we're looking at the relationship between just two variables.
That's it. We're starting with the simplest possible model to create a baseline. We're going to regress the API score on just one predictor, parent education or ed parent.
And the results from this simple model are, well, they're pretty dramatic.
They are. The regression output gives you two key numbers to start with, the intercept and the slope. The intercept is -400.31, and the slope coefficient is 79.53.
Let's pause on that because interpreting coefficients is a guaranteed exam question. So the intercept, -400.31. What does that number physically represent? I mean, can a school get a negative score?
That's the perfect question to ask. Mathematically, the intercept is the predicted value of y when x is 0. So it's the predicted API score for a school where the average parent education is 0 years.
Which is impossible.
Exactly. It's an extrapolation way outside the range of our actual data. So in this specific case, the intercept doesn't have a practical real-world meaning. It's just a mathematical anchor for the regression line. Don't spend too much time worrying about it here.
But the slope, 79.53, that's the important one.
That is the core of the finding. The interpretation, and you should memorize this phrasing, is for a one-unit increase in the independent variable, we expect the dependent variable to change by the amount of the coefficient.
So for every additional year of average parental education,
the school's API score is predicted to increase by 79.53 points, holding all else constant. Though in this simple model, there's nothing else to hold constant.
That feels like a huge number, a massive effect.
It is. It's a very large effect size. And there's another number from the output that confirms this.
Yeah.
The R squared.
The R squared is reported as 0.835.
Right. So the R squared, or the coefficient of determination, tells you how much of the variation in your dependent variable is explained by your independent variables.
0.835 means?
It means that 83.5% of all the variation we see in school performance, from the lowest scoring to the highest scoring schools, can be explained by this one single factor, how educated the parents are.
83.5%, that is an astonishingly high number for any kind of social science data, isn't it?
It's almost unheard of in cross-sectional data. It suggests that parent education is just an overwhelmingly powerful driver of school outcomes. But of course, this model is too simple. It's incomplete.
Which brings us to the point of the chapter, multiple regression. We need to add in all the other variables we defined earlier.
Exactly. We now estimate the full model. We regress API on EdParent, but also on NEALS, Englearn, CredTeach, EmerTeach, and YearRound, all at the same time.
And what we're really interested in is what happens to that EdParent coefficient, the 79.53. Does it stay the same? Does it disappear?
Right. We want to see how the effect of parent education changes once we control for these other factors. And the result is that the coefficient drops, but only a little. It goes from 79.53 down to 73.94.
So it's a bit smaller, which makes sense because parental education is probably correlated with things like poverty and language status.
It is. So part of its original effect was actually capturing those things. But even after controlling for them, it's still a massive, positive, and statistically significant predictor. It remains the dominant factor in the model.
Okay, this is a good point to bring up significance testing. This is where students can sometimes get tangled up between the t-test and the f-test. What's the difference?
And the simplest way to think about it is that a t-test is for one variable. It tests the null hypothesis that a single coefficient is equal to zero.
So for each of our six variables, the software will report a t-statistic and a p-value, telling us if that specific variable has a statistically significant effect.
Correct. But an F-test is for a group of variables. It tests a null hypothesis about multiple coefficients at the same time. And in this case study, we use it in two different ways. The first is the test of joint significance.
And that's testing the model as a whole.
Precisely. The null hypothesis for the joint F-test is that all of the slope coefficients are simultaneously equal to zero. In plain English, the null is that our model has absolutely no explanatory power whatsoever.
It's a pretty low bar to clear, then.
It is, but you have to check it. Here, the F statistic is 771.4. That is an enormous number. The corresponding p-value is effectively zero. So we reject the null hypothesis with extreme confidence. The model as a whole is definitely useful.
But the text then uses a more clever, more subtle F-test, the test of partial significance.
This is where it gets interesting, because this test can answer a real policy question. The question is, do the school inputs, the things a principal can control, actually matter after we've already accounted for the huge effect of parental education?
So you're testing just a subset of the variables.
Exactly. We're testing the five variables other than EdParent. The null hypothesis is that the coefficients on meals, Englearn, CredTeach, EmmerTeach, and YearRound, are all simultaneously zero.
We're asking if that whole group of variables adds anything meaningful to the model, and what's the result?
The F statistic for that test is 14.80, and the p-value is 0.000. So we reject that null hypothesis as well.
Which means?
It means that, yes, school inputs do matter. They are jointly statistically significant. Even after you control for socioeconomic status, things like teacher credentials and the percentage of English learners still have a measurable impact on school performance.
Okay, so they're statistically significant, but the text then brings us to a kind of so what moment when it comes back to the R squared.
Yes, this is a crucial lesson.
Yeah.
Remember, our simple bivariate model with just parent education had an R squared of 0.835.
And now our full multiple regression model with all six variables
has an R squared of 0.853.
Wait, so we went through all the trouble of adding five near statistically significant variables, and our model's explanatory power only went up from 83.5% to 85.3%.
That's the punchline. All of those other factors combined only added about 1.8 percentage points to the R squared.
So what does that tell us? What's the lesson for a student here?
The lesson is to distinguish between statistical significance and practical magnitude or importance. Yes, the school inputs are significant. A p-value tells you that the effect is probably not zero. But the change in R-squared tells you that their marginal contribution to explaining the overall picture is tiny compared to the colossal effect of socioeconomic status.
So a variable can be statistically real but practically small.
Precisely. And that's a very sophisticated point to be able to make when you're interpreting regression output.
All right, that really wraps up the first case study well. It establishes the basic mechanics of ordinary least squares, or OLS. Now we need to move on to part two, where we see what happens when one of the main assumptions of OLS is violated.
Right. We're moving on to handling nonlinearity, using the Cobb-Douglas production function as our case study.
So the core problem here is that the standard OLS model assumes a linear relationship between the X's and Y. It assumes you can draw a straight line or a flat plane.
And the economic theory here, which was developed by Cobb and Douglas a long time ago, says that's not how production works. The theory states that output, which we'll call Q, is a function of capital K and labor, L. But the relationship is multiplicative.
The formula given in the text is 1 GUO, alpha K, beta 2, and beta 3. So you're multiplying things together and you have exponents. That's definitely not a straight line.
It's not. If you try to run a simple linear regression on this, you're essentially trying to fit a flat surface onto a curved one. It just won't work. The model is misspecified, so we need a trick. We need a methodological fix.
And that fix is the log-log transformation.
A very common, very powerful tool in the econometrician's toolkit. The goal is to take this nonlinear multiplicative equation and turn it into something that is linear and additive so that OLS can handle it.
Let's walk through the algebra here slowly, because this is the kind of derivation that can definitely show up on an exam.
Absolutely. So step one, you take the natural logarithm, the Gull error of both sides of the equation. So you have Bully on the left and alpha K Duller on the right.
Okay, that's step one.
Step two is to use the rules of logarithms to break up the right-hand side. The first rule is that the log of a product is the sum of the logs. So Bully on A times B, Bully on A. So that turns our multiplication into addition.
Exactly. So now we have ln A plus ln K beta. We're getting closer.
And there's one more rule we need.
The power rule. The log of something raised to a power is equal to the power times the log of the base, so billable dollars times ln A. This is the magic step that brings our exponents, the betas, down into the main line of the equation.
So applying that, we get our final linear equation.
Which is beta 1 plus beta 2 ln K plus beta 3 ln L, and we've just defined beta 3 to be equal to the alpha, since that's just a constant intercept. And now this equation looks exactly like a standard linear regression model. It's just dollar dollar text intercept plus b1 x1 plus b2 x2, except our y is ln q and our x is our
precisely. We can now run OLS, but we have to feed it the logs of our data, not the raw data itself. But, and this is a huge but, another critical point for interpretation, the meaning of our coefficients has changed.
Right. In the first case study, the coefficient was the change in API points for a one-year change in education. It was unit for unit. That's not the case here, is it?
It is not. In a log-log model, the coefficients beta 2 and 213T3 house are interpreted as elasticities.
Elasticity, that's a core concept from microeconomics. It's about percentage changes.
Yes. So if we estimate data 2-2, the coefficient on 1K, proficient on enrollment, the correct interpretation is a 1% increase in capital is associated with a 0.5% increase in output. It's always percent for percent.
Got it. Okay, so let's look at the actual results from the data. The text uses U.S. manufacturing data, but from a long time ago, 1899 to 1922.
It does. And when they run the regression of log output on log capital and log labor, they get a coefficient for log capital, beta 280, of 0.233, and a coefficient for log labor of 0.807.
And the R-squared is 0.957.
An incredibly high R-squared. The model fits the historical data extremely well. But what's really cool about this case study is that we can use these numbers to directly test the original economic theory proposed by Cobb and Douglas.
They didn't just propose the functional form. They actually had hypotheses about what the values of beta 2 and beta 3 should be.
They did. Based on the national income accounts of their time, they hypothesized that capital share of income was about 1/4, so beta $2 and 2555, and labor share was about 3/4, so beta $3, 7555.
So now we have a direct way to test that. Our estimate for labor share is 0.807. The theory says it should be 0.75. Are those numbers statistically different from each other?
This is a classic hypothesis testing problem. The null hypothesis is $0, beta 3 equals 0.755s. We're testing if our data is consistent with the theory. We calculate the t-statistic for this specific hypothesis.
And the book reports that the p-value for this test is 0.675.
A very high p-value. And the rule is, if the p-value is high, the null must fly. We fail to reject the null hypothesis.
So in simple terms, we don't have enough evidence to say that Cobb and Douglas were wrong. Our estimate of 0.807 is statistically indistinguishable from their theoretical value of 0.75.
The theory holds up to the data. But there's a second piece of economic theory we can test here.
Which is the concept of constant returns to scale.
Yes. Constant returns to scale is the idea that if you double all of your inputs, you double your capital, and you double your labor, you should exactly double your output.
And mathematically, in a Cobb-Douglas function, that property holds if the sum of the exponents equals 1.
Correct. The hypothesis we want to test is beta 2 plus beta 3 plus beta 3.
Well, we can just add our estimates together. We have 0.233 plus 0.807. That gives us 1.040.
So it's very close to 1. But close is not a statistical concept. We need to do a formal test. This is a linear restriction on our coefficients, so we use an F-test.
And the p-value for that F-test?
The p-value is 0.636. Once again, a very high p-value. So we fail to reject the null. The data is entirely consistent with the theory of constant returns to scale in U.S. manufacturing during that period.
So this is a really nice example of how you can use regression not just to predict things, but to formally test economic theories.
A perfect example. And just to round it out, for the more visual learners, the text also mentions plotting the isoquants.
An isoquant being a curve that shows all the different combinations of capital and labor that can produce the same level of output.
Right. And theory predicts these curves should be smooth, they should be convex to the origin, and they should never ever cross. And the text confirms that when you plot them using the data, they look exactly as the theory predicts. A real success story for econometrics.
Okay, so part one showed us how OLS works. Part two showed us how to adapt it when the world isn't linear. Part three is, it's more of a cautionary tale.
A very important one. We're moving to the breakdown of the Phillips curve. And this is our gateway to understanding omitted variable bias. I would argue this is the single most important concept in the entire chapter.
Let's set the scene. The Phillips curve. This was a cornerstone of macroeconomics for a long time, proposed by A.W. Phillips back in 1958.
And it described what appeared to be a very stable trade-off, a negative relationship between the unemployment rate and the rate of inflation.
The idea being, if you want a lower unemployment, you have to accept a bit more inflation, and vice versa. Policymakers thought they could just pick a point on this curve.
Right. And methodologically, if the theory is correct, and you regress inflation on the unemployment rate, you should find a negative slope coefficient.
And for a while, that's exactly what you found. If you take U.S. data from, say, the end of World War II up to about 1969, the regression works like a charm.
It does. The estimated slope is negative 1.03. The R squared is a respectable 0.454. The relationship seemed like a law of economics. It was in all the textbooks.
And then the 1970s happened.
And the relationship completely fell apart. If you run the exact same regression, inflation on unemployment,
yeah,
but you use data from 1970 onwards, the whole thing breaks.
It doesn't just go to zero, does it? The slope actually flips.
It flips sign. The slope becomes positive plus 0.266. The data started suggesting that high unemployment was associated with high inflation. They called it stagflation. It was a complete puzzle for macroeconomists at the time.
So from an econometrician's perspective, the question is not what's wrong with the economy. The question is, what's wrong with my regression? Why did it fail so spectacularly?
It failed because of omitted variable bias, or OVB. The original symbol regression made a huge mistake. It assumed that the only thing driving inflation was the current level of unemployment. It left out a critical third variable.
And that variable was expected inflation.
Exactly. What people thought inflation was going to be in the future. The text provides a formal formula for bias, and it's worth unpacking it carefully. The formula is $80E2 goals what squick plus beta 3 gamma.
Okay, let's break that down term by term.
AB22 is the expected value of the slope we get from our simple biased regression. It's what our computer gives us. EBeta2 is the true causal effect of unemployment on inflation, which we believe should be negative.
Okay, so that's the real trade-off.
Right. Then beta2-3 is the effect of the omitted variable expected inflation on our outcome, actual inflation. We'd expect that to be positive. If people expect prices to rise, they demand higher wages, and prices do rise.
Makes sense. And the last term, gamma.
Gamma is the correlation between our included variable, unemployment, and our omitted variable, expected inflation. And this is the piece that changed over time.
So why did the regression work fine in the 1950s and 60s?
Because in that era, inflation expectations were basically anchored. People expected low and stable inflation, and that didn't really change much whether unemployment was high or low. So gamma was essentially zero.
And if gamma is zero, the whole bias term, beta 3 gamma, disappears.
It goes to zero. And our formula just becomes EB2 equal 2x2. The estimate we got from our simple regression was, in fact, an unbiased estimate of the true effect.
But in the 1970s, after the oil shocks, everything changed. Expectations became unanchored.
People started to expect high and volatile inflation, and at the same time, unemployment was rising. So now, there was a positive correlation between unemployment and expected inflation. Gamma became positive.
So now the bias term is positive. You have a positive beta 3 times a positive gamma.
Which creates a large positive bias. And this positive bias was so big that it swamped the true negative effect, beta 2. It literally pushed our estimated coefficient from negative all the way over to positive. We weren't measuring the Phillips curve trade-off anymore. We were just measuring a messy mix of unemployment and runaway inflation expectations.
So the model was fundamentally misspecified. And the solution is to specify it correctly.
The solution is to include the omitted variable. This leads us to the augmented Phillips curve. You simply add expinflation, a measure of forecasted inflation for the year ahead, as a second regressor in the model.
And when you run this new corrected model, what happens?
Two things happen. First, the coefficient on our new variable, expinflation, is estimated to be 1.147. This is very close to 1, which is what theory would predict. It means a 1 percentage point increase in expected inflation leads to about a 1 percentage point increase in actual inflation.
And what happens to our original variable, the unemployment rate?
Its coefficient becomes negative 0.128. It goes back to being negative, and it's statistically significant.
So the trade-off was there all along.
It was there all along. It wasn't that the Phillips curve had died or disappeared. It was just being shifted up and down by changes in inflation expectations. Once you control for those shifts, the underlying short-run trade-off reappears in the data.
It's such a powerful lesson. A regression coefficient is only as trustworthy as the model that produced it. If you leave out something important and correlated, your results can be the exact opposite of the truth.
The ultimate cautionary tale in econometrics.
And that warning about bias and causality leads us perfectly into part 4. The simple OLS model isn't always enough to determine cause and effect. So the text gives us a rapid-fire summary of more advanced methods designed specifically for causal inference.
Right. Think of these as a toolkit. They covered in much more detail later in the book in Chapter 17, but Chapter 13 introduces them through these case studies. The skill is learning to recognize which data problem you have so you can pick the right tool from the kit.
Okay, let's go through them. Method 1, cluster robust standard errors. The case study here is about automobile efficiency.
The research question is basically, did improvements in engine efficiency actually lead to people using less gasoline? The problem is with the structure of the data. You have thousands of observations, but each observation is a specific car model, like a 2005 Ford Mustang or a 2006 Toyota Camry.
And the observations from the same manufacturer aren't truly independent, are they?
Not at all. A Ford F-150 and a Ford Focus, they share engineering teams, corporate strategy, parts suppliers. Standard OLS assumes every row in your data set is an independent draw from the population, like flipping a coin over and over. But that's violated here.
The errors are correlated within the group, within the manufacturer.
Exactly. If Ford has a systemic bias in how they measure horsepower, that error will be present in all the Ford cars, but not the GM or Toyota cars. If we ignore this clustering, our standard errors will be wrong. Specifically, they'll be calculated as being too small.
And if your standard errors are too small, your t-statistics are too big, and your p-values are too small,
you end up with false precision. You might conclude a coefficient is statistically significant when in fact it's not. The solution is simple to implement in any software. You calculate cluster OS standard errors, telling the software to cluster at the manufacturer level.
And what did that reveal in this case?
It confirmed that, no, efficiency gains didn't really reduce gas consumption, because at the same time, manufacturers were making the cars bigger and heavier. Okay. The effects canceled out.
Okay. Method two, the gold standard. Randomized controlled trials, or RCTs. The case is the famous RAND health insurance experiment.
The causal question is simple. Does more generous health insurance cause people to use more medical care? Now, you can't just look at observational data and compare people with good insurance to people with bad insurance.
Why not?
Because of selection bias. People aren't randomly assigned insurance in the real world. Sicker people are more likely to seek out and buy more comprehensive insurance plans. So if you find that they spend more on health care, you don't know if it's because of the insurance or because they were sick or to begin with.
The two effects are confounded.
Completely. So the RAND experiment, which was a massive undertaking, solved this by using randomization. They recruited thousands of families and randomly assigned them to different health insurance plans. Some got free care, 0% coinsurance rate. Others had to pay 95% of the cost.
And because the assignment was random, the groups were, on average, identical in every other way: age, income, prior health status. The only systematic difference was the price of care.
That's the magic of randomization. It eliminates selection bias. And the result was crystal clear. The groups with more generous insurance, lower prices, spent significantly more on health care. It was a true causal estimate.
A powerful but often expensive and difficult method. So what if you can't randomize? That brings us to method three, difference in differences, Dedi. The case is from South Africa.
Right. We often have to evaluate policies that have already happened. In the mid-1990s, the South African government rolled out new health clinics in some communities, but not in others. The question is, did this program improve child health, which they measured using weight for age scores?
Again, you can't just compare the clinic towns to the non-clinic towns after the fact.
Because the government likely didn't place the clinics randomly. They probably put them in poorer, less healthy communities to begin with. So a simple comparison would be badly biased.
So DIT uses the fact that we have data from before and after the policy. It looks at the change over time.
Correct. It's a two-step subtraction. First, you calculate the change in health for the treated group, the towns that got clinics. So their health after minus their health before.
Then you do the same for the control group, the towns that didn't get clinics.
Exactly. You calculate their health after minus their health before. This captures any general time trend that affected everyone, like an improving economy or a drought. The final step is to subtract the control group's change from the treated group's change, the difference of the differences.
And that isolates the true effect of the policy.
It does. And the result was a 0.522 increase in the weight for age Z-score for children in the clinic communities, a statistically and medically significant improvement that could be causally attributed to the clinics.
Okay, on to method four, regression discontinuity design, RDD. This one feels a little like magic. The case is about political incumbency.
The question is, does being the incumbent, the person already in office, give you an electoral advantage next time around? And the bias problem is, again, obvious. Incumbents are, by definition, winners. They might just be higher quality candidates, which is why they keep winning.
So how does RDD solve this?
It exploits the fact that in many situations, there's a sharp cutoff. In the U.S. election, you need 50% of the two-party vote to win. RDD says, let's look at elections that were incredibly close. Compare a candidate who won with 50.1% of the vote to a candidate who lost with 49.9%.
Those two candidates are essentially identical in terms of quality, fundraising, everything. The winner was just a little luckier on election day.
Exactly. Right around that 50% cutoff, winning is as good as random. It creates a natural experiment. So we can treat the barely winners as our treatment group, they became incumbents, and the barely losers as our control group. Then we look to see how they do in the next election.
A really clever design, and the result.
The study finds that being an incumbent gives you about a 5% to 7% boost in your vote share in the subsequent election. It's a pure causal estimate of the incumbency advantage.
Okay, last one. Method 5. Instrumental variables. 4. This is often seen as the most difficult to grasp. The case is a huge question. Do good institutions cause countries to be rich?
The problem here is reverse causality. Sure, maybe good institutions like property rights and the rule of law cause GDP to grow. But it's also plausible that as countries get richer, they can afford to build better institutions. The causal arrow could go both ways.
So OLS is useless here. We need an instrument. What is that?
An instrumental variable is a third variable that has two special properties. First, it has to be correlated with your variable of interest, institutions. Second, it must not be correlated with your outcome, GDP, except through its effect on institutions. It can only affect GDP via that one channel.
Finding such a variable sounds incredibly hard. What did they use here?
They used something really creative. Log settler mortality. This is historical data on the death rates of European colonists centuries ago.
How on earth is that a valid instrument?
The logic has a few steps. One, in places where European settlers faced high mortality rates from diseases like malaria and yellow fever, they didn't want to stay. So they set up extractive institutions designed to just take resources and leave.
Okay.
Two, in places where mortality was low, like North America, they settled permanently and brought their European-style institutions with them. Property rights, courts, and so on. So settler mortality is correlated with the type of institutions that were set up. The first condition is met.
And the second condition, that mortality doesn't affect modern GDP directly.
The argument is that those historical disease environments don't have a direct impact on GDP today, now that we have modern medicine and public health. Their only lingering effect is through the political and economic institutions that have persisted for centuries.
So it meets the criteria. And using this instrument, what did the study find?
It found a strong causal link. Better institutions do, in fact, cause higher GDP per capita.
Wow. That's a whirlwind tour of some very advanced methods. That wraps up the causal toolkit. We have one last very practical section to cover. Part 5, data carpentry.
Section 13.9 in the text. This is the part of the job that nobody talks about, but that takes up, you know, maybe 80% of your time as a researcher.
It's not the glamorous part.
Not at all. We often call it data wrangling or data munging. And the text breaks it down into three main tasks: importing, combining, and cleaning.
Importing seems simple enough, just getting your data into the software.
It can be. If you get a nice clean CSV or STATA file, it's easy. But sometimes the data you need is trapped in a PDF table or on a website, and you have to do web scraping. It can get complicated fast.
Then there's combining, merging different data sets.
This is where things get really dangerous. Imagine you have one data set with GDP by country and another with education levels by country. You want to merge them. But what if one file calls a country United Kingdom and the other calls it UK?
The software won't match them. You'll lose that data point.
You'll lose it. Or what if you're merging U.S. states and one file writes New York and the other has NY? You have to be incredibly meticulous and standardize everything before you merge, or you'll introduce huge errors into your data set without even realizing it.
And the final step, cleaning.
This is just basic error checking. Looking for typos. If you have a variable for GPA that goes from 0 to 4 and you see a value of 45, you know that's a data entry error you have to fix. Or, if you have a variable for gender coded as 1 and 2, you better have a code book that tells you which is which. You can't just assume.
The text is very formal about this. It says checking the data is not optional.
It's a prerequisite. Your fancy regression model is worthless if it's running on garbage data. Garbage in, garbage out. It's the first and most important step of any valid analysis.
We have covered a truly massive amount of material today. I think this really does function as a comprehensive study guide.
I hope so. We've gone on quite a journey. From the absolute basics of interpreting a coefficient in the API schools case, all the way to using historical mortality rates as an instrumental variable.
We saw how to linearize a nonlinear model with the log-log transform for Cobb-Douglas. We saw the catastrophic consequences of omitting a variable with the Phillips curve.
And we built up a whole toolkit for causal inference, RCTs, D DID, RDDIV, each one designed to solve a specific kind of bias that simple OLS can't handle.
I think the overarching lesson, the thing a student should really take away from all of this, is that econometrics is not just about typing regress YX into a computer.
Not at all. It's about thinking. It's about design. It's about asking critical questions before you ever run the model. Is my proposed relationship linear? Have I thought about potential omitted variables? Are my observations truly independent?
And maybe the most important question of all, does the result I'm getting actually make sense in the context of economic theory?
Exactly. The Phillips curve is the ultimate proof of that. You can get a result that is statistically significant with a low p-value and a high t-stat, and it can be completely, utterly wrong because the model itself was theoretically flawed.
So we'll leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over based on that Phillips curve example.
We saw how a seemingly fundamental law of economics, a stable trade-off, appeared to completely break down simply because one variable expectations shifted its behavior.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? How many of the economic relationships and facts that we currently accept as stable and true are just one omitted variable away from being disproven?
Are we actually modeling a deep structural relationship? Or are we just living through a period where, by chance, the bias term in our misspecified model happens to be close to zero? That's the question that should keep every empirical economist up at night.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. If you're studying for an exam on Chapter 13, we hope this was helpful.
Good luck with the analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And check your data.
We'll see you on the next dive.